Dude came out today and he said, well, Trump's guilty. He broke the law. It's true, but really, you need to think twice. Do you really want to prosecute a former president who was on television and stuff? John, this guy should be tried. Really, in my opinion, this guy and all those folks who participated in selling the torture program to the U.S. government and then perpetrating it on people of the world should be prosecuted. I think I'm just about out of time, but John Yoo, he doesn't think our esteemed professor at down the block here at the University of California, Berkeley, maybe doesn't think it's a good idea to go after Trump. I guess he didn't commit enough crimes. My name is Dennis Bernstein. The show is Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and there's steam coming out of my ears.
And that wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
The Gap. The Gap. The Gap.
Portland's favorite talk radio at 8 on Fridays returns at 8 on Friday, September 16th. Tammy and Althea are back to bring you thoughtful insights, colorful commentary, activist interviews, and community conversation. Minding it, bridging it, filling it in. The Gap returns to KBOO on Friday, September 16th at 8 a.m.
The Gap. The Gap. The Gap.
Jim Gilbert.
Good morning, Glenn. Nice to see you again and be here at the station.
Am I okay here, Ray? Yes? No?
can't hear any. I mean,
I can hear you in my headphones. Yeah, better than I can hear myself.
I can't.
Well, that means we're on the air then. Apparently. Well, we'll go forward.
Okay. If you can hear me, then let's do it.
Okay. So, and Ray gave us the thumbs up here, so I guess he can hear both of us. Okay. Well, that's Jim Gilbert that is live here in the studio with me.
Yeah, Glenn, well, like I said, it's nice to be here, and we're experiencing, finally got some decent weather after, I've heard this morning that August was the hottest month in Portland or this region ever.
Uh-huh.
Set a record.
We don't, we're going to switch mics out, I think, here. Try something different.
Yeah, let's try this.
Okay. I'll get that one out of the way, we'll go here, and then he'll get me live here. Soon. Yeah, while he's fixing this, assuming that somebody can hear me, I'm reading a book, actually listening to a book called Water.
There we go.
Is this better over here?
Yes, it is. And it the history of the water, just kind of an interesting take on it. But he made a comment that in about a century length of time, we went from human most labor being done by human or animal power. Maybe 30% of all work was done by human or animal power, and the rest was essentially by firewood. And that changed in 100 years, and it went down to about 5% then was human powered. I was reminded of that listening to the Who song, our theme there, which is the mule pulling the plow.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway. Yes, we do have, speaking of manual labor, we've had some great gardening weather. Warm in August, but September's been very good.
September's been really great, you know, but those August days, I'd get up really early, go out and work until 10:30, 11 o'clock, and then we cool our house down by opening up all the windows at night and then, you know, getting as much cool air inside, then close it up probably then. It was probably 9 o'clock in the morning, 9:30.
Yeah.
And then it would stay cool inside. The week, 20 degrees difference between outside and inside.
Yeah.
I was pretty happy with that.
Yep. So we've got a good show here, a full show. We'll start out with listener questions. And I'm going to repeat last month's garden stumper, as we got no answers. Submitted to us. Remember, it was a recorded show, recorded live, but played a recorded show. So nobody sent an answer to that. And I think it's kind of an interesting one. So we'll repeat that. And if you do want to call in with that answer, you too can win a free hand tool sharpening from Coley Farm Store. I will talk about on our plant of the month what a pollinizer tree is and compare that to a pollinator. Just a little esoteric difference there, that's all, but it'll be good for you. We'll talk about harvesting pears and apples and also winter squash. The time is coming, or is here, for some of those. Jim has mentioned that the Cornelian cherry is coming into production. We'll talk about that a little bit. Also, this is the month for planting cover crops, and we'll talk about our favorites and how we do that. Our Dirtbag Dictionary, exudation. Mm-hmm. That also happens when you sneeze. You exudate. Hmm. Right. And then Jim is heading off to Korea and other places in search of plants, presumably.
First overseas trip since the pandemic. You know, that's very exciting. It's going to be actually on the plane at about 7 p.m. tonight and arrive in Korea at noon tomorrow. Our time, not Korean time.
Yeah. And what's annoying me? We'll just get that done right off the bat. This is something that has bothered me for years. And it's not bad today here in the studio. And that is air conditioning that is way too cold. We dress for cooler weather, for warm weather outside, and then we come inside where it's cold. Essentially, and it's just a waste of energy, and we're uncomfortable. But here in the station, pretty nice today. It might be a little too warm in here.
I think it's just fine.
Just fine. Okay, good.
Yep.
So, anyway, that's annoying. Okay. Let's begin with listener questions after I repeat last month's garden stumper. And that is, what do blueberries and pure beeswax candles have in common? If you have the answer to that, or if you have a gardening question, it's the same number. Jim, can you believe that? 503-231-8187, and you will talk first to our ace engineer, Ray, and we will get to that.
It would be nice to hear from folks, too.
Yeah. Well, we did hear from our fine, consistent listener, Heath. Heath in Vancouver, I believe. No, Ridgefield. And he has two questions that I will pose to Jim here. I'll just read what Heath said. The first question regards several tart cherry trees, Prunus cerasus. Jim nods. He planted them 8-ish years ago. A couple of them are not doing well at all. I think some deer may have been rubbing them. Okay, we've got a caller with the answer. Nick, let's try it. You got the answer to the stumper?
Well, I don't know if it's the answer they're thinking of, but I'm going to try.
Okay.
I used to work harvesting blueberries, so this is based on that knowledge, is that a beeswax candle you set on fire, you also set on fire blueberry fields at the end of the season. Like if you're in Maine and the blueberry growing area, you'll see these huge fields just with like a line of fire going down them.
I
don't know.
That's not the answer that I was going for, but that's as good as an answer. I've never heard of such a thing around here for blueberries.
No, we don't do it here. And I used to live in Maine. I don't remember it there, but that's very interesting. I'll have to look that up.
What's
the reason?
Yeah.
The reason is it's a fertilization thing. Though they like acidic soil. So, I mean, these are all low bush, wild variety blueberries. It's not for high bush.
Yeah.
But that's, I don't know, but they do it.
I do
know that.
Do the plants then, those same plants produce the next year?
I believe so. I think they seed themselves because, I don't know. I don't know.
Well, we learned something. But of course, but you, like Jim said, we don't do that around here, and we do have the high bush ones that are cultivated opposed to the low bush.
Yeah. Wait, so do I not get the tool sharpening then?
No, yes, you do get the tool sharpening. So just stay on the line, and Ray will take your name and your phone number.
And okay, cool. Thanks so much.
We'll pass that along to Coley Farm Store, and you get a free hand tool, garden hand tool sharpened.
Amazing.
Great. Thanks for calling in.
Okay. Have a good one.
All right.
So we still want to get the, I don't, you know, Glenn, I don't even know.
You know the
answer
yet. Okay. Well, good. So, it's a mystery for half of us here.
That's right.
Okay. So let me continue on with the question here about the tart cherry that is not doing well. I think some deer may have been rubbing them, but there's some new amber exudate. Exudate, there's that term. And a bunch of suckers coming up from the ground. Any hope for them? There are several more that are looking pretty good, but while they flower, they have never set fruit. Also not a good outcome. So we'll take that one first.
Okay, so the first part of that question, no, probably not a lot of hope for them, because what's happening is that the exudation is a sign of bacterial canker. If you scrape the bark at that point where you're seeing that, you'll probably find that there's no green underneath. That's a dead area of the tree. And the fact that it's got rootstock coming up from the bottom indicates the top is dying and the root system is still alive and wanting to live, so it's pushing up new shoots. But I would say probably the top of the tree is it's finished.
Well, that will lead us to the second part here, about how to replace fruit trees such as this, but I'm going to interject a question in between these two that he posed, in that could one of course, the suckers that are coming up are not grafted. And so it's likely that that would be rootstock rather than the tart cherry.
That's correct.
And okay,
if,
so...
And, yeah, and you could use that for... You could, I know this really well because I've been dealing with it myself a lot. So there's probably a lot of shoots coming up. So depending upon the size of them right now, you could either prune off all of them except one or two and use them for rootstock next spring for budding, or, you know, if Heath has a friend or can do it himself. Get some budwood and actually use that rootstock, because the root system that's remaining underneath that tree is very strong and vigorous, and you would have a much faster tree from that rootstock than you would if you plant a new one.
Well, let me just hold that thought there, and I'll finish the second question here is how to replace the fruit trees that they're not working out. There is an irrigation dripper at these spots, so ideally I'd like to replant at more or less the same spot. Can I just cut them down and plant a sapling next to the stump, or do I need to dig out the stump first, or something else?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Presumably, the root system of the original tree is still healthy because of you seeing all that rootstock coming up. So planting a tree next to it would be fine. You don't have a rotted root rot that's going to spread into the new one. But you are going to have roots, the suckers coming up from that old rootstock. So you'll have to prune those off periodically, just because you don't want to have a seedling cherry tree growing up next to the one that you're planting.
And so this exudate, which is caused by bacteria, is not going to carry over in the soil or maybe on fallen fruit, or just make sure you remove all the dead pieces of the tree that was removed.
Right. I mean, yeah. If you remove the trunk of the tree down to the ground level, you'll remove all of the bacterial canker that's on there. I mean, the problem, of course, is that the reason they have it is because they're susceptible to it, and that won't go. That susceptibility will probably exist in new trees too. But giving them good air movement around. Another way to deal with it is to spray them with copper, which is what's traditionally done. Spraying the copper in the fall, and then in midwinter, will protect them from the spores of the bacterial canker. But the basic idea is that you do have that rootstock at the base, and if you could use that, you would take advantage of the already existing root system, which I would probably try to do. But
it'd require grafting.
Yeah. Then the other question he asked about pollination or the fact that the trees didn't have fruit. I would wonder if Heath knows what varieties they are, because if they're blooming and they don't set fruit, there's a pollination problem. It's either the lack of pollinators or the fact that they're all the same variety and they're not self-fertile.
Yes, or another way to put this, tying right in with our plant of the month, there's either a lack of pollinators or a lack of pollinizers.
Yes, that's right.
That's exactly what we're talking about.
You've got it. Nice job.
So we'll just tie in right there in that a pollinizer is the other tree that would provide the pollen for these cherry trees.
Right.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be another tart cherry. Is that correct?
That's a good question. Probably the main reason being another tart cherry is because you the bloom time is going to be similar.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So I don't remember so clearly about about sweet cherries and tart cherries cross pollinating, but definitely the bloom time is an issue that you want to.
Yeah. So that would be two things for Heath to check out.
Yeah.
Does he? And maybe he'll write in again or call in. He sometimes listens to the podcast later. Does he have more than one variety now?
That's right. Because if all of the ones that are not bearing fruit, the first question I always ask is, are they flowering?
Yeah.
If they're flowering and not setting fruit, as you said, it's a lack of pollinizers or pollinators.
Right? Yep.
Yep. So that's kind of the main clue there.
And just to elaborate a little bit more, a pollinizer would be that insect generally, but it can be a bird or a bat or a mammal. Even humans sometimes
I thought you said the pollinizer was the tree.
I did. Did I speak misspeak? Yes. Okay. Pollinator. Yeah. Excuse me. Is that insect the vector that will bring pollen from one tree to another, or one blossom to another? And generally, we think of bees as that, but it can be, marsupials in Australia or New Zealand or wherever.
Right, birds. I mean, all sorts of creatures that move the pollen.
Yeah.
And then some plants, because I have to say, they don't require pollinators because they're pollinated by wind.
Ooh. True. Yeah.
Wind blows the pollen from tree to tree, plant to plant.
And most grasses and conifers don't need a pollinizer, because the wind blows just the gobs of pollen that are out there. Nobody really suffers from an allergy from apple pollen. You know, it's grasses or weeds or something like that.
Right.
You know, because those pollens are very sticky and they stick to insects or animals or something to move it.
And just to tie it aside, there's a very popular nut tree that grows in our region that does not require a pollinator.
Right. Although it does provide pollen.
Right. There is pollen, but the pollen is moved by wind, not by creatures.
And we've used this, I think, as questions before. Even,
I think
Right, so that's the... if you're from Oregon, it's filbert. Everywhere else in the Oregon, in the world, it's
hazelnut.
Yeah. Right. Okay, well, we tied those all together then.
That was fun.
That means we take a break here.
That's right.
We'll get to our first musical selection, and this has all to do with the Queen and King. How about that? You heard about this, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't help it. I'm not going to get into the politics of it or not, but just to play some Queen and a couple of King songs here. The first... It was from 1964. The Kinks did a live performance at a theater in London, the Playhouse. And this is called Little Queenie, and there's an announcer that talks about these long-haired Kinks. So,
over to the Kinks. And it's a touch of the rock and roll from the long-haired lads as they give us Go, Queenie, Go.
I got love in my throat when I saw walking down the aisle.
Yeah, Little Queenie. The Kinks, Ray Davies.
That's pretty good.
Ray and Dave Davies, both on guitar and vocals there, 1964.
So, Glenn, when you were talking about King and Queen and King, or King and Queen, I thought for a moment I was going to start make a joke about, well, I only thought there was a queen bee, not a king bee. And that reminded me of something that I've been telling people just for fun, and my grandkids especially. My second language is Russian, and the word for joke in Russian is shutka, and the word for a joker is shutnik. So my grandkids say Grandpa's a shootnik, because I tend to find humor in things and tell them about it.
Do they find the humor in it, or just in you telling it?
They love it.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Good. Well, the time is now for harvesting pears. Even the winter pears I've harvested now. The summer pears are probably done for in Portland area. I don't know about out there in the...
We're still harvesting them, but yeah, they're getting toward the end.
Yeah. And apples. Oops. Time to harvest those.
I've been doing it.
Some of them.
You know, I'm having a big cider pressing party. Not a big party, but we're going to press a lot of cider with grandkids in the middle of October. So the last few days, because I'm leaving, I want to get the apples off the tree before they fall on the ground while I'm gone. So I've been picking a lot of apples.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And how much cider do you expect to make?
Well, it would be nice. We could maybe like 10 gallons if we're...
Depends how many apples you got, I guess.
Well, we got a couple hundred pounds at least.
Huh.
So,
yeah.
I was just doing it last night.
And then winter squash, too, is... it might be a little early to be harvesting winter squash. Generally, I like to do it before the real rains set in. But, you know, we haven't had much rain, although we did have some rain. Did you get some rain out there?
Tiny bit,
yeah. It broke our... streak of rainless days officially. We had some also in August, but the way to test for a winter squash is two things. One is visual, in that the side that's sitting on the ground should color up a little bit, shouldn't be real pale yet. If it's a dark green squash, it might even turn a little orangish when it's mature. The other probably easier way to determine is the thumbnail test. If you can put your thumbnail easily through the skin, then it's not ripe enough. So wait. But certainly get them out before the heavy rains in October come. And the other key is to leave as much stem on as possible. Don't leave just an inch. Leave 3 inches if you can, you know, essentially as much as possible. Let it cure in a warm place, so, you know, up to 80 degrees if you have such a thing, for 7-10 days, and then store it in a cool area. I sometimes use an unheated bedroom. Sometimes we just leave them on the counter because they're pretty to look at and then easy to choose from.
And you know, one thing, a couple amazing things about winter squash, you can store them for a year.
Yeah, some varieties. Yeah. I mean, like the butternut, that's probably the longest one that I know of.
It is quite amazing, though. I mean, we eat winter squash in late spring, you know, after the next year. And another interesting little factoid that I have a friend, a neighboring farmer who grows them commercially, and I was asking him the other day, we had lunch together, about his yield, and I knew that it was pretty high, but he was telling me that basically winter squash, they usually get at least 20 tons per acre.
Goodness.
And they've had as much as 38 tons of squash per acre. That led into a conversation, which I'm having hopefully with some legislators, about how important agriculture is to Oregon and how much food we can grow in this state, and how important Oregon could be with climate change as producing more food for the whole country.
Oh, good.
So
good.
Yeah. But that's a lot. Can you imagine 20 tons? How much food that is?
Right. Well, some of these squash can be huge.
Yeah. I thought it might disturb the way the Earth spins. It's so much weight in one spot.
Yeah, you better be careful what the legislators decide to do. Okay. Another thing, you should have already harvested your onions, I believe, at this point. But if you haven't, tip them all over. And if they're still growing, break the stalks and let them cure. Take the water away. Don't irrigate, and let them dry in the field just upright, and then after the soil is dry, you can pull them up or spade them up. Don't clean up the husks. I think I went over this last month too, or at least last year. Don't clean them up. Just leave as many husks on as you can, and store them with those husks on. And then when it's time to use them, of course, then you can clean them up, but not before then. You have to go against every instinct if you're a neatnik.
Right, not a shootnik.
You're right. Right. So that's what we've got here on harvesting and then storing. Do you want to say anything about storing the pears or apples?
Well, basically depends on the type of apple. We of course love the winter ones, when the ones that like ripen later typically will store in a cool room for several months. The earlier ripening ones typically have to be refrigerated for the longest storage time. And I should also mention that the harvesting, it's best when we talked about this before, when you're harvesting fruit, that it should come fairly easily off the stem. Like with a pear, typically it's pretty heavy fruit. You just sort of lift it up and it just comes right off. Mm-hmm. That's when it's nice and ripe and ready to go, even if it's still firm. Because it will, like a Bartlett pear, of course, you pick it when it's firm and let it ripen, it becomes soft on the counter.
Yeah, that's kind of the way it is with all pears, is better. I mean, a winter pear would increase in quality if it went through some cold storage
right.
first, but it also can just ripen
yep.
On the...
Yeah, now, with the one exception of Asian pears, which of course...
Yes, right. Oh, good distinction there.
Yeah, which we can pick, you pick and eat.
That's right. And it's time for those right now, too, is it not?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, summer past gone.
Yeah. It's a very very productive time of year right now.
It's most of the labor is harvesting, although I just finished pruning my summer pruning my pear tree, my big pear tree.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how many thousands of cuts I made. It's just incredible. You know, I'm trying to keep a standard tree really pretty small.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it keeps your hands in good shape. You
know? It does. Yeah. I practice. My right hand is so much stronger than my left hand.
Yeah.
But with my left hand, you know, if we open up a tin of something, you know, can of beans or something like that, I can't do anything with it. My left hand, but my right hand, just by itself, I can crush it.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'll shake hands with our left hand.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's get on to. Oh, what time is it, Jim? Yes, it's time for the garden stumper.
Yeah.
Are you ready to go there, Ray? Yep. Well, we thought it was time.
Here it is.
Okay, well, I'll just go ahead and mention the answer to last month's garden stumper, the one that I was actually looking for, and that is, what do blueberries and pure beeswax candles have in common? And the pure beeswax, well, that was a hint, or the pure part was, because you won't find this on paraffin candles, and that is, both have what is called bloom. In blueberries, it's that powdery little white coating to a blueberry. It's called bloom. And pure beeswax will also have a little, it's not a dusting, but it looks similar to what blueberries have. And it's also called bloom. With beeswax candles, you can buff it off with a rag or just heat it up very ever so slightly. But it's a sign of pure beeswax. So if you see that in the candle sitting on the shelf, and you see a slight little whitish, you know, not mold, but you can get the idea. It's pure beeswax, and nothing wrong with it at all.
Interesting. thank you for that.
You're welcome. Okay, and Jim now has our new garden stumper having to do with pineapple guava.
Right. So this is I'll tell a little tiny little tale here. So you.
Oh, are you going to be a Schutnik?
This is not a Schutnik.
Okay.
This is not a Schutka. This is a real thing. But so I imagine many of the listeners are aware that the kiwi, the actual kiwi fruit, it got its name because it was made popular by New Zealand breeders, but the actual plant is native to China. And it used to be called Chinese gooseberry years ago and stuff, but that's where kiwi was made popular by New Zealand, where the kiwi bird lives. Well, there's another fruit that the New Zealanders have worked with and made very popular, at least popular for me, and we're trying to make it that turn more people onto this because it's a wonderful fruit and plant, which is the pineapple guava. But the pineapple guava is also not native to New Zealand. The garden stumper is. What country is it native to? Where does it grow in the wild?
Uh-huh. Okay. Good one. So if you know the answer to that, you can give us a call right now, 503-231-8187. Or you can, if we don't get an answer here in the next 30 minutes, you can email us your response at thedirtbag@kbo.org. Okay, well, you want to talk a little bit about Cornelian cherry, then we'll get into cover crops?
Sure. Yeah, so, and part of this Cornelian cherry story, I was going to mention, so my partner, Lorraine, has been working really hard for probably over 2 weeks to get our old website up and running again for Northwoods Nursery, which is, of course, a wholesale nursery. It's not a retail website, but we do have a little article on that website about Cornelian cherry, and it's northwoodsnursery.com. So anybody who wants to go there and take a look. It's basically the Cornelian cherry story comes about because it related to Ukraine, where I first discovered large fruited, sweet and delicious Cornelian cherry fruit. And that was I traveled there in 1990 when it was still part of the Soviet Union. And I eventually met a breeder, a woman who spent pretty much her whole life working on improving the quality of Cornelian cherry fruit. Her name is Svetlana Klemenko, and we're still in touch, and hope to see her one of these days again. But the Cornelian cherry plant is native to that region and was grown commercially and probably still is. I know in different areas around Ukraine, and the plant itself is distinguished by a couple of interesting things. One is it blooms very early with yellow flowers.
How early is early?
February.
Okay.
Yeah, and pollinated by little flies, because I remember the first time when I was first growing it, I wondered what could be pollinating this, going back to your word pollinator.
Mm-hmm.
Where are the pollinators? Well, I looked around for a while, and apparently they the ones in the U.S., they're tiny little flies that do the work, at least that I've noticed. It's too early for bees, but they do a good job of pollinating. We get a good crop every year. The fruit is it's not really a true cherry, of course. It's a member of the dogwood family, and it's elongated with a long seed inside, juicy. When it first on the, it'll turn red. Most of the varieties are red. There's some yellow ones. But when they get dark red and get just about to fall off the tree, you can, again, almost pick them like you would a pear, but they're still sort of firm. You can pick them at that point, and then on the counter they will ripen and become quite sweet and really good for fresh eating. And you can also make juice with them and different things too. But a very popular fruit in Ukraine.
How did it get the name Cornelian cherry?
Good question. It looks like a cherry, kind of, but it's long.
Uh-huh.
But the Cornelian part, I have no idea.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice to know. And now is when they're starting to ripen up, is that
yeah,
what you're
absolutely.
Saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's continue on our musical journey, and then we'll get back to cover crops here with the Queen. And now we'll move into the King part. And this is a song from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, and I chose it, the Rascal King, because the new king, you know, was really a supporter of organic farming and you know, climate change issues and other things. And now the worry is that just because of tradition, he has to just kind of be, he can't take any positions. So we'll see what happens there. But anyway, the Rascal King, they're here, that's what it's called, the Rascal King.
From and made so many problems to crack and miles to fade. Crooked was the math and brazen was the walk. A cocky swagger up the ladder, and could he ever talk? Last around, I do it again. The rascal king behind the bars of the fun in front of them. Last around, I do it again. The rascal king behind the bars of the one in front of them. For love of God and constant contradictions and just a smile, wink and nod. What stranger fact of fiction and never ceasing to amaze. On a regular basis, first hand into his pocket. And it's the last around, I do it again. The rascal king behind the bars, all the fun in front of them. Last around, I do it again. The rascal king behind the bars, all the fun in front of them.
Kind of hurts to cut into that one, but we got stuff to talk about here, Jim.
That's right.
The mighty, mighty Boss Tones. That reminds me of something my mom said once. She said, "Don't think of me as your boss. Think of me as your friend who's always right."
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, yeah. So you can use that. All right. Cover crops. I have seeded some short-term cover crop. I'll just admit this here. I seeded it in a lot across the street that's being developed.
Mm-hmm.
Tore the house down, but they seeded it with this spray-on grass seed. You know, it holds it in place and whatnot. And then it'll grow. So I figured, well, they're not going to be building on that anytime soon. So I went over and I sprinkled a little bit of cover crop seed of my own. One, buckwheat, which will bloom in 30 days, 30 to 40 days. I thought, might get a little forage for the bees on that.
Uh-huh.
And also some, what was it that I did? Oh, Phacelia. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which will bloom in the spring, but they'll probably build before then, but wasn't much. But anyway, that's cover crop.
Mm-hmm.
Just putting something down on a piece of land or garden bed that otherwise would be fallow. And I would argue that it is the most important thing that you can do for your soil over the winter, fall and winter and into the spring. It has all sorts of benefits, from protecting the rain, the soil from being compacted because of the rain. It adds organic matter, some of them, most of them that we plant. The word escapes me right now, but they fix nitrogen in the soil. With the help of bacteria, a certain type of bacteria, rhizobacteria, can take nitrogen from the air and convert it into a form that plants can use when the cover crop plant dies. And they provide habitat during the winter and provide blooms and all this organic matter. So the ones that I use are these ones that provide nitrogen. The word is legume that I'm thinking of.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly fava beans and crimson clover, both of which are very attractive to honeybees. and they don't really easily reseed. That's one of the reasons that I don't typically use any of the vetches, because they too readily seed for my garden beds. But they are also good, excellent cover crops and nitrogen fixers. The fava beans are the ones that I use. The banner fava bean are not really the best fresh eating, and so they're better used for a cover crop, and they're smaller than the big fava beans, but still they don't. You have to essentially draw a furrow in the line to bury the seed, rather than just broadcast it on top of the soil. Although they can sprout if they're on top, but it requires pretty damp weather for them to survive that. And we certainly don't have that now with crimson clover. That's a smaller seed, and that can. And what I do is, after I prepare the bed, essentially just removing the biggest debris that's on the soil and the plants, we'll just broadcast it with my hand, and, you know, throwing handfuls, trying to evenly distribute it, and then I just rake it in with a garden rake, the tool that has, I don't know, what are those tines, two to three inch tines, mm-hmm. dozen of them or whatever, garden rake,
yep.
rather than a leaf rake.
Right.
And just to break up the soil and or cover them as much as possible. Some, of course, aren't going to be covered, but enough of them are. And as soon as we start getting rain, they'll germinate and grow. Some now, maybe 3 to 6 inches, and then they'll become dormant, and it may snow on them and whatnot. But come February, they'll start growing again, and then produce blooms in. April, maybe into May. And the books will say to make this green manure, meaning that you're going to leave those plants in the ground, or you're going to till them in. But I would argue that most homeowners don't have any equipment that's going to cut them up enough that they will break down quickly within a month. Even it'll take them longer than that. So what I recommend, I mean, if you had a tractor, I'm assuming Jim has a tractor, you know, with a disc or something on there that, you know, that can just break them up and away you go, that'd be great. But I don't, and so what I recommend doing is just cutting them off and composting the tops, and not rototilling, just leave the roots in the ground. The plant is dead. That nitrogen now becomes available to the plants that you will plant, maybe tomatoes or squash or potatoes or anything, essentially. So those are the two that I use. I know, Jim, you have a whole different regime.
Yeah, we're of course, a little larger scale, as you probably can imagine.
Yeah, a lot larger.
Doing acres of stuff. And so what we do is... For many years now, I've used something either rye or I've just recently discovered triticale as a substitute for rye. I like it a little better. It's all fall planted, winter cover crop. And then we also have been planting that with common vetch, which climbs up on the triticale and does the nitrogen fixing like you're talking about. And
pardon me for interrupting here. Sure. Does the triticale ever bloom?
It gets close to it when we're before. But, okay. Probably when it's 5 feet tall or so, we mow it.
Uh huh.
And then we disc it after that. And the vetch never has a chance to make seeds, so we don't have a problem with any mm-hmm. residual seed that comes up the next year. So it works pretty good.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, I wonder. We have such a good stand of triticale. I've been thinking of like growing it. We have some acres. We have some ground we're not using right now, and I thought, well, maybe we should just harvest it. but so far, we've just been putting it back.
Well,
on the soil.
I'm wondering if it's a bee plant.
Well, it's a grass, so if bees like grass.
Well, it depends. I mean, some they do. Huh. I mean, for pollen.
Yeah.
Not nectar, but.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it definitely blooms for us, and if we let it, if we had let it stay, I'm sure it would make grain.
Yeah. What would you use it for if you did grow it out?
Well, that's another good question. Presumably, you could sell the grain. You could harvest.
Oh, I see.
You just grow it for the grain. You know, or you could make hay out of it or something.
Yeah.
But I'm. Like you're talking about, I when I first started farming, I remember very clearly thinking to myself and probably telling people, I said, I want to leave the soil that I'm using in better shape than it was when I started.
Yeah. And well, where you are, there's probably no danger, at least in our lifetimes, that it's going to be built. Homes are going to be built on that.
Well, that's a whole other subject, isn't it? we live in Oregon, Glenn. We have protections, hopefully, and we need to be vigilant. But yeah, right now, I mean, we're, you know, I'm so happy to be out where we're 40 minutes south of Portland and surrounded by hazelnuts and vegetables and blueberries, and it's great.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Okay. Well, that's cover crop. We're still looking for an answer to Jim's question of where the pineapple guava is native to. Most of the research has been done in New Zealand, but that's not where it's native.
Right.
So, 503-231-8187. Let's get to our Dirtbag Dictionary term now, exudation. We made reference to this earlier, mm-hmm. about the cherry tree had exudate on it.
And sneezing, too.
Well, we did say that.
Yeah, and you know, that was a very good Heath's question. Talked about the very thing that that word was referring to, which I thought was important for people to recognize that primarily prunus plants suffer from bacterial canker in our climate, and peaches and almonds. Well, not so much almonds, but peaches and cherries and plums will get that disease, and it's. There are some varieties that are more resistant. More vigor usually helps, but that's what you'll see. The sign of bacterial canker is exudation, usually sort of a bronze-colored exudation on the trunk that will indicate, or branches too, that indicate that there is dead tissue underneath.
What is this amber material made of?
You know, I think I would say it's probably sap.
Sap. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's
hard. Well,
becomes hard.
Yeah,
but at first it's not. And uh-huh. and I think amber itself. There's it's actually called that material. And I remember there was something years ago about bugs that would get stuck in it and get encapsulated in it. And
uh-huh.
that was somehow pretty. And then it would become hard. It was kind of an interesting phenomenon.
Now that I think about it, I don't know where the amber came from. Is it a mineral? I mean, in the case of fossils.
Well, good question.
Jeez, we didn't do our homework here on this one.
No, we knew what we did about exudation.
Okay,
exudation.
Right. Good enough.
Yeah.
Okay, it looks like we have a phone call here, but we'll see if we.
We have an answer to the stumper.
Okay, who do we got here? Alia.
Is it South America, the pineapple guava, Brazil, maybe?
Well, that's very close, but we want, there's a country in South America.
Oh.
Ah.
Yeah, that's pretty, but you could probably come up with a good guess if you thought about South America.
Uruguay or Paraguay?
Uruguay is actually a small part of the native area. What's just north of Uruguay?
Argentina?
Brazil.
Brazil. I said Brazil at the beginning.
You've got it. I mean, Uruguay is close enough as far as I'm concerned because it is native there.
Wow. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, geography.
Yeah, Ray, we do have the answer here. So, yeah, we have one. Right.
Yeah.
So,
are there any guests involved?
You stay on the line and you give your name and phone number to Ray and you get a free sharpening of a garden hand tool at Coley Farm Store in Northeast Portland. You've got her on there now. Okay. All right. So
she's South America was a good start, and we led her through that one a little bit. But Brazil, it's very interesting. And I actually, my partner Lorraine and I actually went there to the native range of pineapple guava, and it was fascinating to see. You know, there's actually monkeys that live there, and they scream like this really blood curdling scream. It was like off in the distance, thankfully, but boy. But the plant is—it's pretty interesting, you know. This beautiful evergreen shrub is growing there, but the New Zealanders saw the value of it and did the work with breeding.
And when did that breeding start?
1930s.
Oh,
yeah. And there's old varieties from then, those older ones, but there's some really new ones now that are really great. I mean, really super. That we were actually able to get. Permits and also the work with the breeders to bring them into the U.S. So names like Kakariki, Anatoki, Kaitiri, those are all New Zealand pineapple guava varieties that are really tasty fruit, large, excellent fruit, and early ripening too, which is for us here in our climate, it's important.
Is that a new name, pineapple guava, or is that what they were in Brazil?
Well, feijoa is the more common name in some countries.
We've talked about that, yeah.
Pineapple guava is what we have been called it here for a long time, so we continue doing that.
All right, Jim, we've got 3 minutes or so for you to give us a preview of what you're in search of wild pineapple guava.
Well, unfortunately, this, you know, we've been to New Zealand 3 times for that purpose, but this trip is not going to New Zealand because there, of course, it's spring, and when we go to New Zealand, we want to go in the fall when the fruit is ripe.
Oh, yes.
But what we're doing is so 4 p.m. today, actually 7 p.m. tonight, we get on a plane, go to San Francisco. From there, we fly to South Korea, arrive there at their time, 4 a.m., which is a little weird, but, you know.
Oh, okay. We can take a quick call on Amber.
Sure.
Okay.
Amber is an exudate from conifers. It's when it's in its liquid form, it's pitch. Okay. And the gum, the exudate from cherry is a gum rather than a terpene or terpenoid or whatever the sap pitch is from the conifers.
And so these bees or whatever insect might be fossilized in amber, maybe got stuck in it.
When you see wounds on something like a dug fir, it will drip pitch.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what I'm thinking is that some dumb critter walked into it, or a big glob of it fell on them. But the cherry exudate is more of a gum, in terms of chemistry. And don't get me into that, please.
No.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much.
That helps a lot.
Store apples and pears apart.
That's also a good tip. And check regularly. So any of the, if there's spoilage, keeps it from touching other ones.
Right, get them out of there.
Ethylene gas is emitted from apples, and it will cause pears to ripen.
Yeah, so don't do that. Yeah, thanks for just proving, Jim, our listeners are smarter than we are sometimes.
That's great. Call again. What is your name?
He's gone. Lee. Okay. Well, we could have. Okay, so you're in Korea now.
So I'm in Korea, and our primary focus there is going to be on Schizandra vine, which some people might know about. The Korean name is Omija. They have a festival for this plant, which is a really nice, it's an attractive vine, very highly valued in Chinese medicine, makes a red berry. But what they do in Korea with it is they make a syrup, and they take the berries from this vine, they mix them half in a jug, half and half by weight with sugar, and they put that in the refrigerator and let it sit. And a month later, the sugar has taken out the juice from the berry, and you pour off the syrup, And it is so delicious. It makes the, we use it to make like a drink where we just put a little bit in a glass and put some carbonated mineral water in. Great, really good.
Yeah, I remember, and now that's coming back to me, that you've grown this.
Yeah, so that's what our focus in Korea is, and we probably don't have much time, right?
We got about half a minute.
Okay, so from Korea we fly to Uzbekistan, where we meet up old friends there, and our focus in Uzbekistan is pomegranate. Uh-huh. And we're going to be looking at collections of pomegranates around the country and see what we can discover, looking again for information and possibly varieties that we can grow here in the Northwest that might be better adapted to our climate. So that's going to be the thing there. And then from Uzbekistan, we go to Italy. And that, of course, all we'll do there is eat pizza.
Oh.
But no, actually, we're going to be looking for olives. And we're visiting some really unusual regions of Italy. It's a very diverse country. I'm really fascinated by this. There's a place we're going where there's actual a crater lake.
Huh. You haven't been to these areas before?
Not to these areas. Oh, okay. And they're cooler areas away from the ocean, where we're hoping to find varieties that may be better adapted for Oregon. Yeah.
Great. Okay, well, you'll be back for next month's program.
October, yeah. We'll tell you about it then.
Right, okay. Great. Well, thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Glenn.
Making the trek in, and safe travels
thank
to you.
You.
Wear your mask.
That's right. Absolutely.
And my brother, in June, went to Hawaii, where he got COVID.
Oh, my gosh. so many people getting it.
Yeah. Okay. We are out of time. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Ray, Ace Board Op, who came in to help us out today. We will have a live show next month, and then re-record for November. That's all. Thanks for listening. Be well. Oh, we'll go out with our last tune here, Professor Longhair, Big Chief.